I just would encourage you, you know, to close your eyes if you want. It should be enjoyable to listen to a talk. If anyone hasn't heard the conversion story of Scott Hahn, that's a good way to spend an hour. But don't do anything else except listen. It's on YouTube. Don't do anything else except listen. I think probably all of us are musicians. We know how to listen. I mean, back in the day, I transcribed stuff that wasn't available from records. And so you'd have skips, and you would remember a specific piece. This is where the skip comes, you know. But that's something I really feel like we've lost. So hopefully we can give that to our children. I want them to have that. Okay. Now it's written. I will try to, and I'm going to send you the MP3 if you want to take notes or something. I'll send you the MP3 and you can do whatever you want with it. You can take notes off there. But I think it'd be great if we could all listen. I will try to read with the correct emotion. I promise you that the emotion was there when I wrote it, because I don't have any use for false emotion or trickery or people who tell you stuff, oh, this works, try it, but they know it really doesn't, or they don't really believe in it, you know? I don't have any patience for that. So I promise you that when it was written, the passion was there. Okay. Point number one. I will tell you the points, at least, so you can know that there is an end to this eventually. This is going to be cut in half. We'll do some of it tonight, and then tomorrow we'll finish whatever needs to be finished, okay? So I'll tell you the points. The great theologian, Father Leslie Rumble, who lived from 1892 to 1975, the master theologian, who created radio replies, was once asked if reception of Holy Communion constituted cannibalism. Father Rumble, who was a convert to the faith, and I hope you've all read radio replies. Watershed is scanning it, and they're going to put it up online. This is what Father Leslie Rumble replied. Christ is not present in the Eucharist under a form in which cannibalism could be possible. His body is really and substantially present, but not in a natural way. It is an entirely supernatural mode of presence which you may not believe, but which at least excludes all notions of cannibalism. I'll read it again. Christ is not present in the Eucharist under a form in which cannibalism could be possible. His body is really and substantially present, but not in a natural way. It is an entirely supernatural mode of presence, which you may not believe, but which at least excludes all notions of cannibalism. Therefore, with Mass and with Holy Mass and liturgy and everything that we do, we are dealing with something supernatural. So I felt that it was important to remind us that we're dealing with supernatural, because today what I'm going to tell you is purely practical. No theology, no anything, just practical stuff. Point number two, what is our goal? As choir masters, we desire an orderly choir that comes each week and takes the music seriously. The American way is to try something for 5 seconds and give up. The American way is to say, I am here until the precise moment I stop being entertained. The mature way is to realize, for example, that great composers such as Bach and Victoria have things to teach us, and each year that we study them, our knowledge will grow and the music will get better. One of the reasons being a choir master is so difficult is that we must fight against an American tendency that is different than, for example, the Filipino culture, which to this day still places tremendous emphasis on musical training for the young. This is the last day you'll see me in a suit. I usually wear the Filipino barong, so enjoy it. If I may be permitted just one aside, the American tendency is the reason that a lady in Texas once screamed at me at the top of her lungs that she would never read a translation of the Roman canon in Latin. What a statement on her part. On the one hand, we profess that the Mass is an unspeakable mystery. On the other, the lady promises me to go to her grave without caring about 5 or 6 paragraphs if they appear in the official language of the church. And if you've seen the Liber Usualis, the entire Mass, the entire order of Mass, is printed at the beginning of the Liber Usualis. And I think it takes up 4 pages, maybe 5. The whole Mass. 5 pages. No, I'll never learn this. I'll die before I learn this. I wasn't happy, by the way. My mother-in-law and father-in-law realize that language has power. I'm married to a Filipino. To this day, my mother-in-law and father-in-law speak to each other in a Filipino dialect. Now, they've known English since birth and speak it perfectly. Indeed, they came to the United States a decade before I was born. But they realize language has power. My lecture is not about language. Although, come to think of it, a lot of you probably have to deal with Latin and people that don't like it and so forth. But I just cannot proceed without noting that the Bible also realizes language has power. For example, Mark 5, verse 41 says, "And taking the damsel by the hand, he saith to her, Talitha kumi, which means, damsel, I say to thee, arise." Why did St. Mark feel the need to include the original language? Or consider Matthew 27, verse 46. "And about the 9th hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani? That is translated, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" Why did St. Matthew insist on giving the actual words and give a translation? Waste of time, waste of space. Why not just say what he said? But let us get back to the subject at hand. Most of us went to the conservatory where hundreds of young, energetic, healthy musicians, all of whom could read music, were required to attend choir 3 times each week. Then when we got our first church jobs, we encountered something vastly different. Very few volunteers can read music, and the commitment to attend rehearsal is sometimes absent. No pun intended. Can we succeed? That is the subject at hand. Is it possible? Point number three. The great pianist Vladimir Horowitz was fond of a Chinese proverb. "Seek not to follow in the master's footsteps. Seek what he sought." Horowitz, who, by the way, was a good pianist, was correct to value this proverb greatly. Do you understand the proverb? Don't follow in his footsteps. Seek what he was seeking. You see, I have already told you the goal, but I cannot tell you how to proceed. I can only tell you what I have done. You remain free to use my suggestions or to discard them. Point number four. Father Robert Scaris has often said, "The life of a choir master is a life of sacrifice. Each of you has made many sacrifices, and never doubt that your life will continue to be difficult." One reason I hope we can host this conference every year is so we can strengthen one another in a very difficult line of work. The stress is so high, many choir masters develop physical diseases. Let me share with you a personal challenge. Our people in Los Angeles live so far away, rehearsals are impossible for some members. I almost never see my full choir until about 5 minutes before Mass begins. And by that time, it's too late to rehearse because the people in the pews are deep in prayer. For 2 years, I've tried a variety of methods to get members to come to weekly rehearsals, but my success in this area has been uneven. That's a word that's in vogue these days, uneven. Some members come to rehearsal faithfully and have a perfect attendance record. But more than 60% of our members almost never come to rehearsal during the week. We do have a rehearsal before Sunday Mass, but even there, we have members who have to skip because they have to go to confession, for example. And by the way, I fully support them going to confession because a sacrament is more important than choir practice. And that's not something that's open to negotiation. That is a fact. Some people in my circumstances would have given up. Now, this is going back to the 90s, by the way. My dad is a big basketball guy. Hopefully I pronounced their names correctly. After all, can you imagine the Chicago Bulls if Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, Tony Kukoc, Steve Kerr, and Dennis Rodman were never on the court at the same time until the game started? A choir is a team, much more than a basketball team is. Instead, I have found ways to deal with these challenges. Only you can prevent forest fires. No. Only you know what your challenge is. Maybe you have a bad priest. Maybe you came into a situation where everyone keeps comparing you unfavorably to the director who came before you. Maybe your church secretary is very slow when it comes to paying for musical scores. Maybe you lack something such as the ability to read open score. Only you know the challenges you face. Point number 5. Something that has helped overcome our challenge in Los Angeles has been the creation of rehearsal videos. You are free to use these rehearsal videos if you wish. Some have contended that rehearsal videos don't constitute true musical formation, but they're wrong for 2 reasons. Number 1, the first step toward any level of musical ability, any level, is singing. Even when a person cannot read music, you have to start somewhere. Number 2, even though I'm a very good sight reader, I have lost my ability to memorize choral music because I read music so well. And that's not a good thing. So reading music has its disadvantages. I know we don't think that that could possibly be true, but reading music has its disadvantages. I cannot memorize music. I just read it. I've become very good over the years. Point number 6. I want to talk about your own formation for a second. These talks I'm giving are not meant to be a substitute for your own formation. Now, there are people out there who claim that a week-long conference or workshop can solve all your problems, and that's not true. I have had excellent teachers over the years, and this talk cannot substitute for that. I sang the full propers each week for years, and this talk cannot substitute for that. I had excellent conservatory training, and since I was 7 years old, I've spent hours trying to find the perfect fingering for compositions by J.S. Bach. These talks cannot substitute for things like that. Finally, I've made thousands of mistakes over the years in front of hundreds of people, and nothing can substitute for the humiliation and knowledge gained through those. Now, point 7. What I'm going to show you is how you can avoid becoming frustrated as a choir master. I will begin now, and I will finish during my second presentation tomorrow morning. Point number 8. This is very important. The cardinal rule is sing, sing, sing. Don't talk. Don't tell stories. Don't spend too much time on music theory or liturgical history or stuff like that. Your people are coming because they want to sing. Your time with them is so limited, there's no time to waste. You might be afraid to hear them sing. You might be discouraged when you hear them sing because they are probably nervous. But you must resist the temptation to talk too much. You must sing, sing, sing. Point number 9. Now, there is no question that much information must be given to the choir members. I've already mentioned that I almost never see all my members at the same time, so even the most basic instruction can be impossible to give. And why is that? Because some use the phone, others don't have a phone. Some use text, some prefer email, and so forth and so on. Your priest may think it is easy to communicate an order to your group, such as the proper time and way to receive Holy Communion, but it's not easy. People have a lot on their minds, and you might tell them the same thing many times, but they don't hear it. This happens to all of us, not just choir members. Moreover, many people are constantly joining the choir or leaving or rejoining, and they are absent for long periods of time. Therefore, we often sing the so-called public service announcements. Did you remember when we were doing that earlier? That way, they're having fun, and they remember better. And in the meantime, they're learning to blend as a group and memorizing the prophecy tone, which is very seldom sung. Point number 10. Regarding attendance, never get angry at your people for their absences or for being late. You must learn not to get angry. You must always start on time, regardless of who is there. Never wait around for people to arrive. Never comment on people not being there. That's a morale killer and a waste of time. You must learn ways to use the time properly regardless of who is there. I am not saying this is easy, but you must learn. To put it at a very basic level, if you have two pieces, a three voice and a five voice, it might be better to practice the five voice when all the singers arrive and work on the three voice first. If you know that a particular singer needs to work on a particular piece, but they send a text message saying they're going to be late, it might be better to rearrange the order you had planned. If you know that certain singers have a low range or a high range, but they send you a text message saying they're coming late, it might be better to alter your rehearsal schedule, which you had carefully planned, so that a piece requiring a high range is sung by those singers. Point number 11. You will have times when only one or two singers show up for rehearsal. Take that opportunity to work with them, especially with solfege, which we're about to speak of, and in particular, focus on intervals with them. Don't just drill them the entire time to the point where their voice is being damaged. Point out the various intervals as you teach them. You'll be surprised how much progress can be made with even one person thanks to solfege. Point number 12. When I was thinking about attendance, I just realized some people that said they were going to be here aren't here. That's okay, though. Now, let's talk about solfege. I said the cardinal rule was sing, 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 correct? But as choir masters, we have another cardinal rule: do not neglect solfege. You'll notice I placed solfege in the score books. Did you notice that? Mm-hmm. Number 13. I could easily spend 2 hours talking about solfege, but we don't have that much time. Let me therefore point out that solfege is an inviolable relationship of half steps and whole steps. Let's sing that. Listen and repeat. Solfege is an inviolable relationship.
Solfege is an inviolable relationship
of half steps and whole steps.
Of half steps and whole steps.
If you think whole steps and half steps are something to be glossed over, you're wrong. We must spend years teaching our singers to be able to hear the difference and sing the difference between half steps and whole steps. Half steps and whole steps are how we create intervals. That'd be a good thing to sing too. As time goes on and after many months, your choir must begin the process of learning how do mi sounds. They must be able to produce that sound without help. They must then progress to do fa. I'm just tossing these out. It doesn't matter which ones you start with. It doesn't matter. I'm just using this as an example. Then fa do, then do sol, and so on and so forth. The good news is there aren't that many common intervals, perhaps 9 at most. The bad news is for a singer to be able to correctly produce even one interval in any context can take years. Point 14. Solfege is an inviolable relationship, but there are exceptions that can be made. For example, T can become te. Indeed, there are even pieces where nobody is sure what note do is, such as the Vexilla Regis by Palestrina. By the way, if you want to learn more about this, look up the theorist Pietro Eron, who died in 1545 AD. I spent a lot of time on that person when I was in college. We would normally want to use the solfège do from the original chant. But remember that in polyphonic music, the composer places the chant melody at various pitch levels. And there's also transposed clefs, there's also traditions and so forth and conventions. Moreover, sometimes the original plainsung melody is notated differently in the medieval manuscripts. We looked at some medieval manuscripts earlier today, by the way. Just as sometimes plainsung melodies were classified in different modes depending on which monk did the cataloging. And remember that in modern music, starting around 1675 AD, your do can change to a different location throughout the piece. Then, too, some used fixed do, while others are trained in movable do. My point is, don't be stressed out if there are multiple places where you can put do. For the most part, it will be obvious where do goes, usually key signature and so forth. People who worry too much about this remind me of those who get upset when Chopin doesn't spell a chord correctly according to them. I'm speaking specifically of augmented sixth chord versus dominant seventh chords, which we may or may not have had to look at a lot in college. The fact is, Chopin would normally not spell according to function. He would spell according to make it easy for the person who's playing the music. The fact is, Chopin was one of the greatest composers of all time, also not negotiable, also not open to any question. And I promise you, he understood the difference between an augmented sixth and a dominant seventh chord. My point is, some people need to loosen up. By the way, the French don't use solfège, they use numbers. In some ways, their system is better than ours. Point 15. You don't need to be a music theorist to be a good choir master, but you should understand the basic intervals, such as perfect fourth, which is made of two whole steps and a half step, whose internal intervals, isn't that great? Internal intervals, say that.
Internal intervals.
Isn't this a riveting speech? Internal intervals can be arranged in any order. I apologize, but if you don't know that stuff, you're in for a rough ride. You might know that a perfect fourth has two whole steps and a half step, but you might not realize that those whole steps and half steps can be arranged in different orders. Or you might not be able to sing. Boom, sing different orders. You might not be able to do that. After all, folks, the diatonic scale only has two half steps, and everything else is a whole step. And yes, we're going to sing that. The diatonic scale.
The diatonic scale.
Only has two half steps.
Only has two half steps.
Everything else is a whole step.
Everything else is a whole step.
To make your life easier.
To make your life easier.
The half step, or one of the half steps, always comes immediately below do.
One of the half steps always comes immediately below do.
Below, not below. Below do. It's not that hard. It's not that hard, folks. There's only two half steps. Find those two half steps. One of them's always below do. But it can be hard if someone puts you in front of a thing and says, sing a perfect fourth right now, sing a minor seventh right now. Point number 15, the shortest point. Here are the three reasons. That's point number 15. Now let's go on to point number 16. Reason number one. It allows the solfege, in other words, we're talking about solfege, the three reasons why solfege is the thing, that, the key to your life. Number one, solfege allows the conductor to refine the pitches, tuning, and rhythm in a way that singing words does not. By the way, I just thought of another one I could have added. People who don't read music can do solfege, but when you start talking about key signatures and this and that and flats versus sharps and relative minor versus relative major, yeah. So that's another thing, but that's not on here. Oh, but it's on the tape. Number 17, point number 17. So this is number two. This is the number second reason why solfège must rule your life. It provides the singers with musical training that can be applied to every piece they will ever learn. It can be built upon because do, sol will always be do, sol. And do, mi will always be do, mi. And do, la will always be a minor third, and so forth and so on. So they learn even though they don't realize they're learning. In fact, if you don't use solfège, you're not really teaching them, because you're just saying, this note is wrong, that note should be higher. Higher than what? I mean, that's worthless. You're not teaching them anything if you say that. Point number 18. And this is number three, the third reason why solfège should rule your life. When you are training a choir, the worst thing you can possibly do is start at the beginning of a piece and repeat it over and over. That's like trying to learn a foreign language by memorizing the dictionary. Starting with letter A. You must take the piece apart and approach the difficulties from 1,000 different angles. And solfège will help you do this in a powerful way. Then when it comes time to run the piece from beginning to end, the singers will not be bored. On the contrary, they will be amazed that they seem to magically know the piece after just doing the solfège. If you consistently bore your choir members, you won't have a choir very long. Point number 19. This one's called Always Start with the Hardest Part. Another way to take a piece apart is to begin with the most difficult section. When you've made progress learning the most difficult section of a piece, you'll be amazed how easily the rest of the piece falls into place. An analogy here might be a movie. Good movies usually begin in a certain way, then progress through the introduction of characters and plot exposition, then at last have a major conflict and resolution, and then have a winding down period where you see the characters one last time and they all say, that was great how we did that thing, right? Each choir rehearsal must be like that. You should plan so that they will tackle the hardest parts, in other words, do the very hardest work, when they are most receptive and happy. I cannot tell, this is so weird to be saying this to my actual choir members. I cannot tell you when this is, but in my experience, it usually seems to be about 20 minutes after choir practice begins. That seems to be when choir members are the most focused. And sometimes it's good to stop them during rehearsal and remind them, folks, you're working very hard, and when this choir rehearsal ends in 25 minutes, you're going to look back and you're going to be happy that you applied yourself, and you will be glad that you didn't give up when the going got tough. It's important to remind them about that. I have an advantage here because somehow I can always look at a piece of choral music and I know in advance which sections will give choir members the most trouble. I don't know how I gained this skill, but perhaps it was the years and years I spent at all hours of the night recording singers. This skill of mine can also be a curse, because sometimes I know what will happen, and it still happens. I even tell the choir members what will happen, and it still happens. This gets back to sing, sing, sing. Even when they get something right, you must drill them on it over and over. Worst thing you can do is say, okay, you got it right, we're done. Horrible, terrible. They're going to be in a different spot, so forth and so on. Point number 20. You ready? For years, I was afraid to conduct rehearsals without a keyboard. The idea of running a rehearsal without a keyboard terrified me. In college, it was actually a conductor I didn't care for. I hated him. I didn't know if I can even say that in this talk. I don't think that's right to say that you hated somebody, but I did not like that conductor. He then tried to add me on Facebook like 10 years later. It was actually isn't that a terrible thing to say? But he was a bad conductor, and he hurt our ears, and he treated us like kids. He was a high school teacher, that's why. It was actually a conductor I didn't care for who taught me the keyboard is not necessary. You might be afraid to have rehearsal without a keyboard, and that's normal. All I can do is encourage you to get over this fear sometime down the road. Point number 21. Speaking of the piano, we choir masters have a tendency to drown out singers when they are not sounding good. You must resist this tendency because it accomplishes nothing. If your singers have a weak sound, drowning them out on the piano will not fix the problem. Give them a chance to sing it a few times and you'll be amazed at the progress they will make. When the piano stops pounding in their ears, they will hear that they have a weak sound. That will force them to start making improvements. Number 22. Speaking of giving them a chance, I must share with you something very important. Sometimes you will only have a small portion of your choir at a rehearsal. You will be stressed because you will be asking yourself what you can accomplish with such a small number. The answer is you can accomplish a tremendous amount if you use bridges. Bridges are when you have two sections, let's say alto and soprano or tenor alto, it doesn't matter. You pick a difficult spot and you have the alto sing a few measures, then you have the soprano come in without giving them starting pitches. And then you drill over and over. This is the most valuable thing you can do. In fact, this is how we spend 80% of our rehearsals. It makes the piece solid in a way that you won't believe. Many of you have probably studied counterpoint. But your education in counterpoint will take on a whole new meaning once you start breaking it down into bridges. It's kind of like reading about war in books versus actually experiencing it. It's one thing to look at counterpoint and play it on your piano in the privacy of your home, but man, when you start actually hearing it and working, it's amazing. It really is amazing. I could say that I learned a lot by taking off 8-voice pieces and 4-voice pieces and 6-voice pieces off the records, CDs, and transcribing them because I didn't know they were available in the library, so I'd do it by ear, and that's how I learned a lot about counterpoint. And you learn the rules, and you learn why the rules are there. So many people are like, okay, no parallel fifths, okay, no parallel octaves. If you can't hear those, like, you need to be able to hear why they're wrong. You need to be able to hear why they're wrong. And of course, they're not wrong in all contexts, but in the context that they are wrong. By the way, sometimes you learn when you teach. For example, I found a spot at the ending of an Alleluia where it does a Mendelssohn-esque diatonic stepwise ascent of two octaves. So you learn when you teach. That's why you don't teach the same piece every year after year after year. Don't do that. Learn new pieces. Point number 23. There's a URL there if you want it. Sometimes you'll sense the choir is getting bored with just drilling something over and over, especially if they are not making progress. Take every opportunity to point out the intervals to them. Descending fourth, ascending fourth, and so forth. Pardon the pun. And here's a resource that might help, and then I give the URL there, okay? Also, it is okay to break the monotony with a little bit of history about a composer, or a compositional technique, or palindromes, or melismas versus syllabic music. I've been known to do that with my choir. Too much. You may need to explain and demonstrate certain techniques, such as imitation, over and over before every member of the choir understands. If they truly understand, they should be able to articulate what you're talking about. Call on them. Allow them to explain the technique. I've never done that, right, Emily? This is a very good use of rehearsal time. One thing I especially like to point out is the golden mean to singers and shape and all that. It's really kind of cool. Number 24, if possible, look into the possibility. That's a great sentence. If possible, look into the possibility of taking courses on how to educate. There are techniques that can be applied in choral music. Let me give you the Cliff Notes version. You know what Cliff Notes are? I never used them. I wish I had, but I never did. Here's the Cliff Notes version. You ready? Different people learn things in different ways. Some learn hourly, others visually, others by repeating, others by reading a manual, and so forth. You must vary your teaching techniques. For example, one teaching technique is allowing individual members to repeat back and articulate what you just said. Believe it or not, the other members will pay attention more when it is someone besides the choir master. There's no question about that. They will be interested in whether that person correctly understood. They might have had questions too, but were embarrassed to ask. Another teaching technique was the one I mentioned where I never speak directions. We sing them. Right, choir? Okay. If you have singers missing a rhythm, have them come to the board and tap out the rhythm on the board and keep them there until they do it right. When voices cross, you know what that means, right? When the voices cross, it's like, oh, that's, I know what that is, and that's easy. No, it's not. When voices cross, design on the fly, just off the fly, a way to drill it, whether spoken or pitched, until they know beyond a shadow of a doubt where they come in. That's another thing, as pianists and so forth, voice crossing, it's no big deal. It is a big deal. It is a big deal. Make it fun and physical, and you'll be surprised how much everyone learns, including you. We think music is easy, but it's not. We think voice crossing is easy because we've studied music since we were 6 years old, but it's not. One thing I wish I'd learned is the physical solfege hand symbols, do, re, mi, fa, sol, and all that. And this is something on my list of things to do. I want to learn them better. I hated them in college, but now I know how foolish I was to reject that. Number 25. Of course, at that time, I was going to be a concert pianist, right? Never thought I'd... That didn't work out. You know you're in trouble when you go in to study piano and the other people in your grade have already toured other countries as soloists. Number 25. In my opinion, the only reason people... Okay, my choir members have to close their ears here. In my opinion, the only reason people will come back week after week to your choir and never doubt that volunteer singers sacrifice a ton is if you present to them what I call a course with shape What do I mean by shape? It's not easy to describe, but essentially it means a grand vision of how you introduce music and concepts to your singers. By the way, you will never receive credit for all the thousands of hours you spend behind the scenes planning. So don't expect praise. It's the hardest thing. It is the hardest thing is to plan, but no one is ever gonna, it's just, oh, this piece magically got here and it somehow, you know, no. So don't expect praise. No one is going to understand that. You're the priests of these two people, is that correct? They're your musician? See, when I wanted to do conferences originally, I was going to make it mandatory that every single musician bring their priest. Because without the priest knowing, very little can be done without the priest supporting you. Without the priest supporting you, very little can be done. And I wanted to tell the priests that a lot of times the musician, the major work they're doing is just planning and researching. I doubt they know that. Of course, on the other hand, what do priests do between Sunday and Sunday? No, just kidding. That's a joke. Joke. They do a lot, especially, yeah. All right, so don't expect praise for planning, because you're never going to get it, but boy, it's so important. Number 26, let me give you an example of shape. And remember, as I already said, not everyone will agree with this. So feel free to close your ears if you have a different opinion. This is my opinion, and you don't have to agree with it. Each Mass should have a shape to it. It should not consist of 100% Gregorian chant sung by the four best musicians in your parish who never let anyone else sing. It should not be 100% Renaissance polyphony sung by the choir without any involvement by the congregation. It should not be 100% pieces played on the organ, sorry, Megan, with unison choir. It should not be 100% a cappella music with no organ music. It should not be 100% Baroque music. It should not be 100% modern music. It should not be 100% emotional music. It should not be 100% thick and complicated counterpoint. In my view, each Mass should have a shape with a mixture of styles. Some pieces should have organ, but not all. Some chant should be sung by soloists, but not all. Some should alternate between men and women. Some should alternate between cantors and choir. Some are sung by the priest, others by the deacon, others by the congregation. Some pieces should use modern harmonies. Some should use Faux-Bourdon. Some should use Falsi-Bordone. Some should use canonic imitation. Some should be simple and unaccompanied. Some should be SATB hymns, and so forth and so on. This shape will greatly add to the prayer of the congregation. Moreover, your choir members will enjoy the variety and will keep coming back for more. Let me just explain that really quick. A lot of the music that we do, it would have been contrasting to the people of the time. Sometimes just like a switch between full choir and soloists, and they would have appreciated that, and they would have heard things that we don't hear anymore. Our people, like, your music is pretty much the only classical music they'll hear in their life. They listen to beat music on the radio. They don't listen to quality music. Music that has depth. So that's why I say the variety between these things will help them in a way that perhaps another generation might not have needed. I mean, these people were sensitive to the smallest little changes in the music, but we're not anymore. Moreover, your choir members will enjoy the variety and will keep coming back for more. One of the worst liturgies I ever attended was at a certain church which shall remain nameless. They had about 4 or 5 hymns through Mass, and they sang all the verses, complete with improv, transposing the last verse up, with SATB harmony and descants. Every time each hymn would end, I would feel as though Mass should be over. I mean, these people, they started at their verse 1. They blew the house down by the time Every single time. You know how you can progress, right? You start with verse 1, 2, 3, 4. You start adding organ improvisation, SATB. Then you have improvisation again. Then you go up to a higher key. Then you blast it with descants. All through Mass. 4, 5, 6 of these things. Every time the hymn would end, I'd feel the Mass is over. My ears were exhausted. Whoever planned that Mass has no liturgical sensitivity. And I don't care how much you like hymns. I love hymns. Save your loud organ music and descants for the very end of Mass. Okay? But like I say, nobody has to agree with anything I just said, but that's just what I said. Point 27. Let me rein this in. I'm going to rein this in, maybe get one or two more points done, because tomorrow I'll be done in plenty of time, and you can, like, go to the bathroom or something, you know, so you're not rushed, because we need to come in like this tomorrow, right on time for that rehearsal. So if I just do one or two more paragraphs, then tomorrow we'll have time to dismiss you early, because it's important to, like, you know, use the restroom or go get a drink or something. Deal?
Deal.
What choice did you have? Just kidding. 27. Oh, this is a good one. The very scorebooks themselves were created to show you what I mean by this. They have a mixture of musical styles and performing forces. I even tried to show you, and this is very important, that hymns can be sung with only two voices. You see, many choirs don't have enough voices to sing SATB, especially when there are tons of really low bass notes, because not everyone is like you, Scott, or Iffy. Are those my basses here? That in itself is a lesson. All of you are musicians, and you can sing SATB. You probably can sight read it immediately. But it's not about us. It's about what can we do with the people. So if you want to, they're like, man, they do unison, okay, but SATB. If you try to do SATB with a hymn and it sounds sad, and it sounds like sick, what are you doing? Oh, because I want to do SATB. Well, okay, but what's the result of that? It sounds sick and sad. So, but this might be a way, that's why I put that in there. It's not that you can't read four voices. It's not that you can't do that. You could have done it. I could have given it to you the last second, you would have sight-read it perfectly. It's to show you that you can start to take them from unison. Okay, let's add two. And then that'll lead, as it did with our choir, that'll lead eventually to the SATB. So that in itself is lesson. See, I could talk your ears about right now. I could talk your ears off. Let me try that again. I could talk your ears off about what makes a good contrasting program, and you'll wish that I would stop. Or I can show you what makes a contrasted program. And it's in those books. Okay? 28. Another thing you should notice about the score books. None of the music is excessively long. You need to understand that the longer polyphony goes, the more chance there is of a disaster occurring. 2 minutes is already quite long. And we all came from the conservatory, and my choral program had 360 singers. And we did big works, long works, powerful works. Really, really long. I think Dr. Calabrese went out, but you look at the guy's career. He's conducted all over the world. Big works. You know, Bach, Mass in B minor, that kind of stuff. And so you're like, well, why is he telling us short? Because you're not in a conservatory and you're not with people who have to be there, you know, or they get, you know, penalized. So 2 minutes is already quite long. And I usually prefer 50-second snippets. Then we usually alternate with a chant verse or something else. Because if your choir crashes and burns at the 4-minute mark in an 11-minute piece, some choirs never recover. But if your piece has plenty of stopping places, you will be okay. It's called setting yourself up for success. By the way, I've learned over the years, and I continue to learn each year, that it's better to do relatively simple piece exceptionally well rather than to attempt a piece that's too difficult. And yes, we're going to sing that. It is better to do a simple piece well.
It is better to do a simple piece well.
Than to attempt a piece that's too difficult.
Than to attempt a piece that's too difficult.
I think we can start the next one when we come back. Let me just say one thing about that, JFK. What did he say? And about that, I would say this. Let me say this about that. Let me say this about that. You know, you might think, oh, this is the greatest piece, man. We're going to be able to do it because I got just enough basses and just enough tenors, and it's going to be great. Who here does not know what an understudy is? You do not know what an understudy? An understudy is when you have a play or something. Let's say you have Romeo and Juliet. You have another person as Romeo and Juliet that never gets to do anything. They're only there. They have to be at every rehearsal. They have to memorize everything. They're only there in case the other person gets sick or dies. Now, but we don't plan like that. We say, I got just enough basses to do this, and I got just enough tenors to do this, and I got just enough sopranos, and it's going to be great. Well, what happens when, okay, this family gets a stomach flu, this one moves away, this one, whatever. I mean, like, you need to not assume that everybody's going to be there. But who wants to do an understudy? I mean, an understudy is serious business. I mean, you're going to have a guy here that sits to every rehearsal and never gets to do anything? Really? That's what's required, folks. That's what's required. So don't choose the hardest possible piece that you could do on the best day of your life. Choose a piece that even if a couple people aren't there, it's still okay. Thank you very much. We'll see you tomorrow morning. Okay. Not going to repeat everything I said last night, obviously. However, two things. Number one, what I'm telling you and what I started last night and what I'm finishing today is simply what I have done to succeed in a very difficult vocation, which is being a choir master, which you know how hard it is. So what you're listening to is what I did. You can take it, you can use it, you can steal it, you can throw it away, you can go online and say, this is the most horrible thing ever. But all I can do is tell you what I did, and then you can see if that's at all useful for you. The other thing is, the recording is because I asked everybody last night, we had two presentations. The Gregorian chant one was given off of bullet points where I talked and it was conversational and we asked questions and we went through all these bullet points, okay? The second talk, this is the second half, this is part B of the second, whatever. Only music theorists can understand that. As music theorists, we have things we say, this is the three of the three of the three chord. But anyway, this is part B of the second talk last night. This is part B of the second talk last night. And for the second talk, I asked everyone to try not to take notes, to close your eyes and to simply listen. And I made the promise that some people really like to take notes and all that, so I said, I will record it, and I will send you the MP3, and then you can take notes and you can do all the stuff that you can do. But I thought it was important to have a different type of presentation where we just listen, because we really lost that. In the culture, we are so busy and we have so many gadgets and computers and everything like that. We've lost the ability to just sit, close your eyes, and just listen to someone, whether it be Fulton Sheen or Scott Hahn or whoever it may be. With that exception that we may have to pause briefly to get the chairs for my friend. So, point number 29. So again, feel free to just listen and use your memory if you like. I will send you the MP3 later. In 1931, Father Carlo Rossini wrote the following in a set of regulations published widely. This is what he wrote. Church choirs of fewer than 10, 15, and 20 volunteer members, his emphasis, are forbidden to sing music for 2,
three, and four voices respectively. So that was his emphasis, the original emphasis on volunteer members. I'll read it again. He wrote, church choirs of fewer than 10, 15, and 20 volunteer members are forbidden, which was, by the way, his favorite word, forbidden, are forbidden to sing music for two, three, and four voices respectively. We musicians think highly of ourselves, and that's fine. However, we often attempt polyphonic music with very few singers, sometimes even one singer per part. And you may ask, what's wrong with that? Here's the problem. Much of this music was conceived for a choir, and the minimum for a choir is three per part, according to Dr. James Dougherty, instructor of choral methods. Because with two voices, one will always dominate the other. So you don't have a choir until you have a minimum of three per part. No matter how wonderful you are as a singer, your pitch will never be perfect. But when five or six people sing the same vocal line, they compensate for one another in a beautiful way. Please understand that many professional groups attempt Renaissance polyphony with only one singer per part, and it frequently sounds absolutely terrible. The worst part is that composers, be it Guerrero, Marenzio, Victoria, Palestrina, whoever, Lassus, composers planned on using fewer voices, or forces if you like, fewer voices for certain movements, such as the Benedictus, to break the monotony. So if you have a mass and you sing the whole thing with one per part, how are you going to have the contrast when it goes into the parts that are supposed to be soloists? By the way, when I first heard myself singing polyphony one per part, along with several other great singers much better than I was shocked. It sounded anemic. Let's always be honest about how we sound, folks, even when it's hard, and there's nothing as hard as recording yourself and listening to it. There's nothing. Many professional groups claim they are trying to be authentic by using tiny choirs, but the evidence doesn't support that. And you can even read some of the letters from Mozart and so forth. For example, with Mozart, we have letters and things where he was able in certain circumstances to use a whole bunch of instruments and singers, and he would double, triple the winds and all that. And he was excited. He said it was so great because we got to do all these doublings. In other words, he wasn't able to do it normally, but when he was thrilled. He was thrilled by the many forces. And unfortunately, the real reason for some, not all, some, is that it's expensive to pay 50 singers, okay? And it's much cheaper to pay 8 or 9. Indeed, many of the Renaissance choirs had 22 or 26 paid singers. It's a good number. A famous Renaissance composer had a choir of about 35, but when his patron went to war, they only had about 16 left because the singers had to take up arms and fight. So you can tell when some of the pieces were written by this composer because of how many voices he used. It was based on whether his castle was at war. And I think he actually himself had to fight too. So in other words, you can tell the guys, he wrote this when they were at war because it's only for this many voices. And the singers had to fight, but that's another story. Again, I say the beauty of choral music comes from choirs. And that's why you must constantly recruit members. So let's talk about recruiting. Point number 30. Oh, I wrote worth thing you can do to recruit. Worst is what it's supposed to say. It's supposed to say worst. The worst thing you can do to recruit is put an advertisement in the bulletin. I wish I could lie to you and say that putting an ad in the bulletin works. Wouldn't that be great? But it's not true. you'll get almost no volunteers from an ad in the bulletin. This is many years in many different states of the United States telling you, it's, I wish. Put in the bulletin, my volunteers will show up tomorrow. You need to understand that it's about relationship. You must cultivate a relationship with your choir members. And we tend to think of them as objects, just a tenor and a soprano and a bass, but it's not. They're people. But never be unprofessional, and I'll talk about that later. These are real people, real Catholics. You are asking them to give you tons of their time. Recruiting is difficult because after Mass, you need to go and get in people's faces. You need to approach them and find out if they have a hidden singing talent. A hidden singing talent. Did you know that people have hidden singing talents? Many of the people in my choir never knew how awesome they were at singing until I forced them to try. It's scary, but incredibly rewarding. In the end, it's never about music or how great your musical skills are, or your keyboard skills, or your motions, how beautiful they are. It's about professional and gentle handling of people. Point number 31. You need to get to know your members because you're going to spend hours labeling their binders, texting them, calling them, and so forth. You must learn that each one has a different way they like to communicate, and you must respect that even though it can be draining. Unless, of course, I suppose you're in a parish where you have, you know, 40 million people just dying to get into your choir, and you can say, this is how I do it, and I post it this way, and if you don't like it, get out. And I suppose, in that case, I suppose you could do that. But where does that exist? Yeah. Number 32. We're on 32, auditions. Never audition people before or after Mass. Just get their phone number and follow up during the week. This also allows you to disqualify bad people. I once had a lady in Texas give me two fake phone numbers and a fake email address. When I confronted her, she said she must have accidentally given me the wrong information. I did not allow her to join, because if you cannot remember your email address or your phone number, you are not going to be a good choir member. In Kansas, I had another, one maybe. Sviatoslav Richter could never remember his phone number, but not three. Not three. In Kansas, I had another lady who was afraid to meet me at the church because she said I might be a criminal. Do you, and it's like, yeah, I've been coming to church all these weeks so that I could lure you to church, whatever. Do you see how you can start to weed people out? Do you understand that someone unwilling to show up for an audition will never be a good choir member? That's the first test. The first test is whether you have your phone number memorized. And then you take it from there, okay? Number 33, point number 33. I like this one. Never look down on volunteer choir members. In my opinion, we are here to teach people from the parish. Who cares if they don't read music? Can they sing in tune? That's all that matters. They will learn about the liturgy. They will learn to read music. They will learn about how to pronounce Latin. Believe me, nothing is as wonderful as teaching volunteers. Professionals are wonderful too, but watch out for the ones who demand special treatment. I could tell you stories about that, but let's go on. Point number 34. You will be tempted to become angry when choir members don't show up. You must never become angry. You must learn to accept the fact that some people will not show up. I wish that children never got sick, but they do. And when that happens, the parent must take care of them. I wish that car trouble never happened, but it does. I wish that traffic jams never occurred, but they do. As a father of two children and someone who has been very sick for the last 3 years and for 2 years could hardly get out of bed, believe me, I've come to understand that some things are beyond our control. Here's the worst part. Usually the big feasts like Christmas and Easter are the ones where your choir members tend to go on vacation or get sick. So you need to have the long-term goal of having such an awesome choir that people will actually stay in town to sing. So never get angry. You must learn to plan for people not showing up. And we talked about that a lot last night. One thing you can do, although it takes tremendous effort, is to bring extra music that can be sung if people don't show up. Sometimes it takes me 3 full days to plan a single Sunday, because what is sung depends on the people who show up, and you have no choice about that. I could sing everything myself, but believe me, I'd have no choir left if I did that every Sunday. Why should they sacrifice if they don't get to sing? Whether you like it or not, some of your best singers are going to move away or leave or have another baby or whatever the case may be. Realize this fact before it happens and use them as stepping stones to a better choir. Don't make your choir reliant on one or two people, no matter how awesome they might be. Point number 35. Speaking of sacrifice, an old proverb says you can win the battle but lose the war. You need to let your singers sing solos. Sometimes they will do poorly, but you need to let them try. That's part of their education, just like all of us have messed up solos in the past. If you sing all the solos yourself, you're not doing your job. You need to let them try. If they mess up, you lose the battle. But if they are so impressed that you gave them a chance, they might just sing in your choir for life, and you have won the war. By the way, you will become furious when you feel like your choir members don't listen to you, or when they make a mistake you feel that you would not have made. Trust me, everyone makes mistakes. One time I got so angry at what a singer did, I wanted to get rid of them. But soon after that, I made the same mistake. It was an ascending perfect fourth. Nerves happen. Mistakes happen. We are in this for the long haul. Speaking of getting rid of singers, here's something important. When drama happens in a choir, we tend to want to address things immediately. What I've found is that we must be long haul people. You know what long haul, right? That's my dad. We're in this for the long haul. Not like hall, like H-A-L-L, which, by the way, Father Popplewell hates the way we say hall. They don't say hall in Australia. They say hole or something. But long haul. What I've found is that we must be in this for the long haul. I have found that problems usually work themselves out with time. This might sound strange, I realize. But keep reminding yourself we are long haul people. That'd be a good hymn, wouldn't it? Point number 36. Speaking of nervous singers, when you have a big event, start teaching the music well in advance, like 6 months. The worst thing you can do is attempt a piece the first time for a big mass, like when the bishop visits. They have to sing that piece many times to get comfortable and get past the nerves. I don't care how good you think you are, nerves affect each one of us. Moreover, you may program that piece for an entire month, but when sickness strikes, you might have to skip a week or two. You'll never regret doing pieces early. Point number 37. You can spend your rehearsal time talking at your people, telling them about this repeat, or this wrong note, or this page turn, and so forth. My experience is that it's better to do as much as possible before they show up, because rehearsal time is precious. Indeed, by the time everyone arrives and gets settled, you've already lost 20 minutes. My composition teacher used to say, write it in or rehearse it in. Rehearsing a professional orchestra costs thousands of dollars per minute. Wouldn't it be easier to write it in rather than rehearse it in? I wasn't a fan of that professor, but he was right about what he said. Write it in or rehearse it in. It made sense. It made sense. Number 38, contrafactum. Okay, we're gonna talk a little bit more about this. We have one more talk where I talk about the internet resources and the repertoire and things of that nature. But we need to talk about contrafactum 38. First of all, contrafactum is used constantly in Gregorian chant. Constantly. Almost every tract you'll ever sing is the same melody over and over again. And that makes some people uncomfortable. Some people have a misconception and they think of it, like we talked about last night, and they think of it as a word-for-word thing instead of an entire sentence. They think of word-for-word, syllable-by-syllable. And they get upset when you point it out to them, because they say every piece is written for the text, and the text comes first, and every piece is written for that specific text, and it fits that specific text. It's not how it was. Almost every single tract you'll ever sing is the same melody, rearranged a little bit, okay? And this is not a recent thing. People say, oh, well, maybe that's, the Neo-Gregorian. No, this goes back as early as we have manuscripts, 9th century. It's called reemployment of melodies or readaptation. This is the earliest thing we have. So if it's wrong, it's been going on a long time. Look at the Canticles of Holy Saturday, for example. Some of the most beautiful chants you'll ever sing. You'll ever sing. Canticles of Holy Saturday. It's the same melody four times. Same exact melody four times. Now, it's used constantly in hymnody. And maybe next year I'll do a whole week on this, because a lot of people don't understand this. And Catholics didn't understand this for a long time. For whatever reason, Catholics didn't put the hymn tune name until, I believe, Vincent Higginson was the first one to do that. I don't know why they didn't, they just didn't. And hymn tune names are confusing, because then they used to take a lot of tunes from German, but then when World War I happened, then they changed all the names because they didn't want to have a German name, just like they, would take dachshunds out and, kill dachshunds, and they wouldn't eat sauerkraut and all that stuff. That went on during World War I. So that confuses matters, because it was hard enough to begin with to know what a hymn tune was. And then when you start changing the name, it becomes even more difficult. So it's used in Gregorian chant. It's used constantly in hymnody. That's one thing I like about the Anglican use parishes. They use the different texts, and they use a text to a tune that you don't expect. And it's like you're singing a whole new piece. It's like, this is so great, and you don't even know what you're singing. It's really neat. Now, amazingly, in Gregorian chant, there's no name for the Gregorian tunes. My friend, who did his doctorate on hymnody in Germany, Bonn, the University of Bonn, he knows all about hymnody. He did a doctorate on it. There's never been a study where they name the Gregorian tunes. I don't know why. I don't know why that is the case. But so it's used constantly in Gregorian chant, it's used constantly in hymnody, it's used constantly in Gregorian hymnody. It's used a lot of times. For example, the 1942 hymnal called Laudate Hymnal, which Dr. Buchholz likes a lot. He was so happy when we put it online. Because it has a lot of German tunes in it. For example, do you know the words Jesu Dulcis Memoria? A lot of times they sing the hymn tune Jesu Dulcis Memoria Dans Vera Cordis Gaudia. Right? That's kind of the one that everybody kind of knows, right? Well, for example, the Laudate Hymnal in 1942, they set Jesu Dulcis Memoria to the same tune that we are singing for the Guerrero hymn. So let me see if I can do it. I didn't write it out, but it would be like Jesu Dulcis Memoria Dans Vera Cordis Gaudia. Do you see how that's the same tune that we sing? So that's what they did. That's what they did in the book. And that's the editor's choice. And there's a billion tunes, and you have to eventually pick one. And no matter which one you pick, somebody's going to be unhappy because I didn't learn it that way. In fourth grade, I learned it with this tune. So that's the right tune, right? So that's the only tune that can be used, right? So, and it was, Contrafactum was obviously used in the Renaissance as well. Falsi Bordone is kind of a good example of that. Although that's almost a lost art form, but that was very important to them. That's a whole nother story, but you know, we have to go to Mass on Sundays, but in those days, the Divine Office on Sundays was part of the obligation. So they had to go to Mass and they had to go to the Divine Office as well, and that's why all those psalms, they sang Falsi Bordone, they used it for all the psalms, because how else are you going to sing 50 million psalms to polyphony? So other instances are less clear when it comes to Contrafactum. Such as discrepancies in text underlay. And that's a good way to get musicologists fighting. Talk about text underlay. You have all kinds of discrepancies with text underlay. You have like things that are in italics. If you look at the major editions, right, you have things that are in italics. That means that the editor, he thought that they should repeat the word. Like if it's Kyrie eleison, then he thought that another Kyrie eleison should be repeated. That's him putting it in there and thinking that's the way that they would have done it. And they might have done it that way, and they probably did do it that way. But the italic shows you that it's his choice. He put that in there. And sometimes, of course, in a lot of these pieces, the composer only wrote the first word. So the whole piece, it could be an eight-voice mass, for example, and at the beginning, underneath the words, it just write Kyrie or something, Kyrie. Or Laudate, or whatever the text is. The singers knew the text by memory, and they knew how to apply it perfectly to the syllables. Now, there's also questions, of course, whether maybe that might have been played by an instrument, perhaps. Or we know that in convents, for example, they would sometimes use instruments on the lower voices because the women couldn't sing that. We don't know the answer. We don't know how they did it. I suspect they did it a lot of different ways. But if I had just put the first word and no text underlay, that would have been interesting, wouldn't it? Of course, they also applied ficta just without it being written too. So not to mention instances now like the Christe by Guerrero, which we sing, which is so beautiful. If you look at the online edition by my friend Nancho, which is usually very good and he has very good sense. He has a very good sense about those things. He's transcribed the whole works of Guerrero, the full works of Morales, the full works of Victoria, all of them. And he also puts the original manuscripts there so you can compare. He has a very good sense, but in that particular piece, the text underlay is bizarre. And I'm patting myself on the back here a little bit. I couldn't use it. It was bizarre. So I changed it according to what I thought was right. Then I went to the UCLA library, pulled out the official edition, the complete works, and it matched perfectly. Because when you have that little theme that goes, Christe, like, wouldn't you want to keep that in each of the voices? So I don't know why Nancho didn't do that, but the edition that we have in UCLA does it the way that I did it. So that was kind of like, okay. Moreover, the Renaissance composers were not strict about cantus firmus, text underlay, in a way that we might expect. and this is something I've had long conversations with several famous musicologists throughout the country. If you're taking the trouble to use a chant melody as your cantus firmus, why not use the text underlay the same way the chant does? And we have the original chants as they would have seen them, right? Because they're not, the Renaissance chant doesn't look exactly as we have it today. We have those. And they still, they used great freedom in it. And it's interesting how they do that. And Guerrero in particular, sometimes I look at his text underlay and I'm like, wow, really? And yet it works. Like that Osana that we sing. I'm like, really? And it just works. But that's a whole other story. But let me give you the most common example of Contrafactum. It's a piece written in 1607 AD, and I suspect most of you already know it. I will not leave you comfortless, alleluia. William Byrd. We sang that in college. But it's a contrafactum piece. The real version, the one that Byrd wrote, is Non vos relinquam orphanos, alleluia. But somebody wanted to use it in English, so they switched it. And I thought it was the original, but no. Byrd, I think, set all of the propers, as in like the whole year, I think, the whole graduale he set. But in Latin. 39. Just as Anglicans have found contrafactum indispensable for hymns, which I don't know why we can't. Next year, I want to give a whole week on this. I don't know why we don't do what they do. It just makes no sense. But just as they find it indispensable for hymns, I find contrafactum indispensable for choir repertoire. And that's why I placed it inside your score booklet. If you notice that Sanctus and Agnus Dei for tonight, not for Tuesday, but for tonight, is the exact same music as the Adoremus by Guerrero, that canon. Exact same music. Please say you noticed that when you were practicing. Yeah. Okay. You won't believe me, but I'm going to tell you anyway. Singers love contrafactum, and they almost never realize when they're singing the exact same piece. They almost never do. Because remember, you cannot do certain pieces at certain times of the year. Victime Paschali cannot be sung during Advent. Regina Caeli cannot be sung during Lent. The Vexilla Regis can only be sung for certain masses, and so forth and so on. So when I came to LA, I changed Palestrina's Vexilla Regis into a Kyrie. And we sang it for 13 months. Then, after we got maybe a little tired of it, actually, I don't think our singers got tired of it, but I was getting a little bit tired of it. Then when I needed a piece for Good Friday at the last minute, because you know how difficult Holy Week is, we pulled out the original piece, the original Vexilla Regis, and we sang it. And everyone was like, oh, I don't know this. And they were so happy when they started singing it and they knew it. But what's the point? See, here's the point. Okay, here's the point. If your choir is so amazing that they can prepare hundreds of polyphonic pieces, good for you. Okay? But my choir's not. You have feasts that come right after the other. You have Palm Sunday, Holy Thursday, completely different, has a Gloria. Good Friday, completely different. Holy Saturday, completely different. Easter Sunday has a sequence. You have the Ascension, the Pentecost. You have all these feasts that come right after the other. And if you're able to do a different motet for this one and that, great. But we're not. We just don't have that capability. So contrafactum can come in very handy for us. My college choirs were not that good, by the way. We spent an entire semester on some pieces. So we'll mention contrafactum a little bit more, how to do it, how you can do it, in that fourth presentation I have. Okay? Number 40. Another technique I find indispensable is layered pieces. Page 70 of your booklets, can you turn there? Page 70 of your booklets describes this powerful thing. I would love to describe it, but I won't, since it's on page 70. So I would love to talk about it, but y'all can read it when you go home or whenever you want. I would only add that layered compositions remind us that music is like building from wood. You must spend hours planning for some things, okay? Like when Father and I built this, it's only gonna be used today. So some things you must plan for, but other things you must not make a final decision until the lumber is about to be cut. You make some decisions when you buy the stuff, and then at the last second you make your final decision. And even the width of the blade can affect your final measurements. So that's like layered pieces. You need the freedom. If nobody shows up, you can still do this. If everybody shows up, you can still do that. So forth and so on. Number 41, let us speak about your demeanor towards your choir members. You must always be professional. I could give you 100 reasons why you must be professional. But instead, I ask you to trust me. Be professional. You will sometimes feel tempted to be goofy with your choir members, and I say again, always be professional. Never laugh at singers. We singers are very sensitive people, and a mean comment can damage us deeply. Number 42. Members of the choir sometimes ask non-crucial questions during rehearsal. They don't realize how precious the rehearsal time is. Other members might want to start a discussion about something not related to the task at hand. The choir master must not get distracted. When these things happen, you must say, "My expectation is that you will turn to page such and such and do such and such." Don't enter the fight. You may feel like you have all the time in the world to goof around, but once Mass begins, you'll wish you spent that extra time preparing choir. We're going to see that tonight. On the one hand, we don't have that much music to get through, but by the time we set up the risers and we make the arrangements and we move around and we do the vocal exercises and we do the vowels and we do all that stuff, and then we get to Mass, it's going to be like, wait a second, like, what comes next? You know. So you may feel like you have all the time in the world to do for him, but once Mass begins, you'll wish you spent that extra time preparing the choir. No matter how familiar your choir is with singing, always review the pieces with them before Mass, saying, "Now, remember, the Kyrie comes after what? Now, what book do you have to have during your hands during such and such a time?" And Dr. Calabrese, I might want to do that at some point today. Just kind of run through what's happening tonight. And, you know, I don't want to interrupt in any other way, but that might be something I can handle in maybe like 5 or 7 minutes or something. You know, we assume everyone knows everything about the liturgy because it's our job as choir masters to know, and some of us are obsessed with it. But Catholics usually don't usually know very much about the liturgy, so we must patiently teach them. 43, don't waste a lot of time describing the sound you want. I had a teacher in college who invariably described choral sound in terms of food. Make it sound like delicious jello. Make it like mushy meatloaf. Make it like cotton candy, and so forth and so on. Don't do that. Just say, make it like this. Demonstrate over and over and let them repeat over and over until they get it right. One of my friends actually went to Iceland and conducted a choir in Iceland. And I was like, how did you communicate with them? And he just demonstrated for them because nobody can speak Icelandic. Is Mark here? I don't think he's here yet. He's not here yet. That's crazy. Yeah, he knows a lot of languages. Anyway, he just demonstrated. The bad choir master tries 3 times to get the choir to sing what he wants, and then he gives up. The good choir master makes them repeat it over and over until they do it properly. Point number 44. Another cardinal rule is to always have tons of music to work on during rehearsal, even if you just run through it once during rehearsal. Choir members would have more fun doing 10 pieces each rehearsal rather than the same piece for 2 hours. I admit this is quite difficult and requires an insane amount of preparation, yet I personally believe this principle helped us gain 37 singers in less than 2 years. Always have difficult music as well as fun music. You're in trouble if you head to rehearsal with an insufficient amount to work on. Always have more than enough pieces to work on. This might be the hardest thing about your job. I did it in the booklets too. We have some appendix pieces that I doubt we'll get to. They're beautiful though. But I doubt we'll get to them. You never want to run out of music. Number 45, expect that there will always be new members coming in. Don't fall prey to the fantasy that all choir members will join during the month of July. You will have people coming and going, so you need to repeat things that some members will already know. By the way, avoid major frustration as a choir master by always having 2 printers available and buy tons of toner and paper, more than seems reasonable. Print early, never at the last moment. Expect the worst when it comes to printers. Number 46, never fight with a choir member over something, such as the pronunciation of a Latin word or something like that. Latin. That constitutes an inappropriate use of rehearsal time. Simply repeat, my expectation is that you sing it like this. Okay? By the way, I know a person who can lecture in 11 languages. And I once talked to him about pronunciation, and his languages are so beautiful. He was the envy of everyone. But you know, he wasn't that particular about it. We shouldn't be so particular about it, because there's sometimes, I don't care how people say my name, Ostrovsky, I don't care. We shouldn't be particular about it. But don't fight with your choir members about it, it's inappropriate. When rehearsal has ended, if you want to do more research, that's fine. If you want to change it later, fine, but don't argue during rehearsal. Also, realize there can be more than one valid way to do something. Sometimes you'll sing under a conductor who contradicts what another teacher told you. Always do what your conductor tells you, and when you're the conductor, you can do as you please. Being a choir master is a very demanding job. Don't add to your conductor's level of stress by fighting with them. I wish I had time to tell you some stories about Alfred Cortot and Anton Rubinstein, but I don't have time. Okay, let's finish this because we got to start rehearsal. Okay, number 47. No matter how hard we work, sometimes things turn out badly. Like when I was moving this thing and my button broke. Sometimes your job is to simply smile and get through the piece. That is, sometimes your job is simply not to explode with rage. Usually after a few days, I look back and realize it wasn't as horrible as I thought. Or sometimes I call people on the phone and talk about it. But getting angry is never appropriate. Some of you that talk to me about it must just put the phone. Okay. Yeah. Here's another trick I've learned. If you get sad news, like half your choir tells you they will be absent, wear your very best clothes and look your nicest. I don't know why this trick works, but it does. That always ends up being the very day you meet a potential choir member, for example. I don't know why it is. Or things will miraculously go better than you expect. Remember that you are the master of everything. You're the leader. Anton Hoffman even called his teacher master, by the way. We should get back to that. They used to do that. You are the master of everything. You're the leader. People's energy, people's enthusiasm, people's focus, and so forth. Everything depends on your positive attitude. I cannot stress this enough. Besides, one of your choir members might be going through a personal tragedy you don't know about. So be patient and pleasant. It's hard. Number 48. Being a choir master is such a hard job, sometimes you have an obligation to get away from music. Don't think about music. When you deal with your choir, you must be happy and upbeat. Sometimes you won't feel happy and upbeat. That's when you must take refuge in solfège, which we talked a lot about last night, or doing something simple like speaking the text together before learning a chant. If you're asked to do something and you have to be a teacher in front of somebody and you're very nervous and you feel sick and you're very afraid and you don't know what you're going to do in front of the choir, maybe you could just, now remember this because you might be in this situation. Maybe you could just quickly just like talk through the text. Maybe just talk through the words really quick or speak through them. That will calm you. Maybe some of you don't have that problem. some of you here are very accomplished conductors. But if you do panic, maybe you can start just that way, just by talking through the text. And then you'll start to feel better. Your mood will improve once the rehearsal gets underway. Okay, number 49. Sometimes choir members will push you to the limit. At that point, you need to realize that it's impossible to give more than your best. Your best is all you can offer. Do your best and be at peace. If they are not satisfied with your best, they can leave. Number 50. A year and a half ago, our choir could barely even sing a tiny little 7-measure, 3-voice piece by Ravanello called Jesu Redemptor Omnium. Now, a year later, we are doing fantastic and complex, sophisticated music every Sunday with about 35 singers, but not everybody always shows up. And we're doing it well. So, may God be praised.